Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University College of Arts and Sciences African American Studies Program. Speaking will be civil rights historian Philip Dre. His lecture is titled Capital Men, The Epic Story of Reconstruction Through the Lives of the First Black Congressmen. We begin with an introduction by Professor Linda Haywood, Director of the African American Studies Program.
Born in Chicago and raised in Minnesota, Mr. Dre now lives in New York City. He is a prolific writer and has been a contributor to many publications, including Mother Jones, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times. Philip Dre also is an independent civil rights historian. He has written several books. I'm just going to mention a few. In 1988, he co-authored We Are Not Afraid, the story of Goodman, Swiner, and Cheney and the Civil Rights Campaign for Mississippi, which was a New York Times notable book. He is also the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America, which won the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Book Prize and the Southern Book Critics Circle Award. At the Hands of Persons Unknown was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the Los Angeles Times Book Award. Today, Philip Dre will lecture us on his new book, Capital Men, The Epic Story of Reconstruction Through the Lives of the First Black Congressmen. Mr. Dre could not have chosen a more compelling and relevant event to write about. Those of us who teach African-American history have told the story of these remarkable men to generations of students as a way of examining the parallel universe of the black experience. Now Philip Dre has made them come alive for an American audience eager to look back on a world which black and white strove to make into a more perfect union. The lives of these first African-American congressmen remain ever so relevant in the new union that President Obama now leads. Again, I would like to have us welcome Mr. Dre.
Thank you very much for that nice welcome. I'm very glad to be back here at BU. I was here once about 6 years ago and really enjoyed myself here at the center. It's also really great just to face a live audience because a few days ago, someone had emailed me and asked me if I'd be part of one of those blog conversations, something I'd never done before, where you answer questions from readers in real time on a blog. And I thought, oh, well, I want to be in the swim and kind of courant and like everybody else. So I said, well, sure, I'd be glad to do that. And I forgot when I agreed to do it that I only type with one finger. And so you can imagine it was really an exhausting 2 hours. It went on for 2 hours, and my poor index finger was so... By the end, I was just writing like, yes, that could be true, I suppose. people were looking for more discussion, but anyway. One of the questions that people asked me on that conversation and also other appearances I've made for this book, Capital Men, is what would the black congressman of Reconstruction, the Reconstruction era, think about President Obama being elected? And I think what they expect me to say is something like they would fall down and shout hallelujah and they would be so amazed. But really, I think what they would say is, what the hell took so long? Because to the Capitol men and other elected officials, black officials of Reconstruction, of which there were 2,000 people elected to various positions throughout the South, sheriffs, tax collectors, judges, state legislators, that was their Obama moment. In other words, they felt that they had arrived. They engaged with the political process very fully, just as they did with education, ex-slaves, former free blacks, varying degrees of education and experience. But the learning curve was very short and very sharp for them. And as both as voters and as elected officials, they became engaged very rapidly with the political process. So to them, they responded to the opportunity that was made available by various Reconstruction-era legislation that pieces of legislation that were enacted, of course, the important constitutional amendments, the 14th Amendment, which granted citizenship, and the 15th, which granted the right to vote. So, I mean, obviously implied in all this is sort of the underlying premise of my book about these men is that, first of all, that Reconstruction, despite its reputation, was actually a very positive phase in American history, a very idealistic time. You had the establishment of federal bureaus like the Freedmen's Bureau, the first large social welfare outreach effort in American history to sort of help the new citizens, the former slaves, of which there were 4 million, sort of resettle in the South. Among other things, they had to make the transition to a wage basis of labor. In other words, Freedmen's Bureau officers would be involved in helping the former slaves negotiate wage agreements with their former masters, that kind of thing. You also had, in 1867, with the Reconstruction Acts, the federal government, Congress, basically say to the former Confederate states, if you want to come back into the Union, you're going to have to jump through certain hoops. And one of these was that the states had to have new state constitutional conventions to sort of democratize the former Confederacy. And one of the tenets of these constitutions was that black men would be allowed to participate and to vote. And so you had really essentially what were the first biracial forums in American history of blacks and white Southerners coming together in these constitutional conventions at the state level to try to sort of renegotiate terms for the post-war era. And you can imagine these were sort of revelatory to people. Nothing had ever, white people weren't accustomed to speaking to black people and hearing really what they had to say. And a lot of Northern reporters went down to sort of cover this phenomenon. It was much commented on at the time, of course, partly because there was a great deal of hostility from a number of Southern whites who refused to participate. There's this wonderful term, masterly inactivity, that some of the Southern whites took, meaning that they would just not even get involved, thinking that the whole experiment would just collapse, and that then they would be welcomed back into authority in the South. Of course, that didn't happen. The truth is that a lot of the African Americans who got involved really did very well in these parliamentary settings, these biracial gatherings, and acquitted themselves fairly well. So, of course, there was all hope, really, that these same people could then go on to fill other elected positions. A couple things I should mention, just as sort of caveats. The offering of the vote to blacks was not entirely altruistic. Part of the aim was, on the part of the Northern Republicans who were looking to reconstruct the South, was that they didn't want there to be a large body of people who could be counted in the Southern representation in Congress and yet were not able to vote. Because already, even before the war, of course, slaves had each been counted as 3/5 of a person. And so what that did is it tended to give the Southerners in Congress a much larger apportionment of representation than they otherwise would have deserved. And so now, of course, that blacks were citizens, they would count as a whole person. That would even enlarge further the white seniority in Congress. And the Republicans couldn't allow that to happen. So it was essential that the freed slaves become voting citizens. Of course, it was assumed they would vote for the party of Lincoln, the party of emancipation, and thus help to kind of balance against the white Democrats. Secondly, another thing it's important to mention is that there was one group of people who were not very happy with the enfranchisement of the former slaves, and that was women who had been in the abolition movement. You know, the abolition movement was sort of originated here in Boston, and the women's movement began sort of formally in the late 1840s, and there had always been a lot of sort of close cooperation between the two. Frederick Douglass was, from the very beginning, an advocate of women's suffrage, that kind of thing. And there was a lot of sort of crossover and cooperation. But what happened is, after the Civil War, the abolition movement kind of split on this issue. And the idea was that, well, we can't ask for both black enfranchisement and the vote for women at the same time. It would be too much. The conservatives would, there'd be too much of a backlash. So the women were kind of asked to wait a generation or so. Well, of course, it wasn't just a generation. It would be another 60 years before they got the vote. But they took this very poorly, the idea that they, who had been sort of loyal to the abolition movement all along, and at the end of the war, they, when the term Reconstruction was bandied about, a lot of the women in the abolition movement thought, yeah, Reconstruction, let's get to it. And they included their suffrage in that. And of course, that didn't happen. And it was a, sort of a bitter divorce between the two. One thing about Reconstruction, of course, that, again, I mentioned that I see it very positively, really. And, of course, not that I'm the first to come to this conclusion, but, you know, for many years and even to this day, Reconstruction has a very bad reputation, as I mentioned. It was the subject of, you know, there have been a lot of myths in American history, whether it's from the McCarthy era of the 50s, of things that we're supposed to be afraid of, or whether there are WMDs in Iraq. Some myths are short-term, some go on for a long time. The Reconstruction myth really lasted about 90 years. And it basically was that Reconstruction had been a time of federal overreaching and excess. The idea of meddling in the affairs of the South had been punitive, that the freed slaves were not ready for the rights that were extended to them, and that with all speed, the white South had to redeem Reconstruction, was the term they used, redemption, to restore white rule as quickly as possible. And so this meant, of course, engineering and kind of propagating this kind of language, which lasted for a very long time, really up until the modern civil rights movement, which is often called the Second Reconstruction because it was seen as almost a kind of a return to some of the goals and literally some of the laws of Reconstruction, which had, I always say it, they were like up in the attic in a trunk all those years. Once the nation turned away from Reconstruction, they kind of put all these things, the Enforcement Acts, the 15th Amendment, even the 14th Amendment to a certain extent, they put them away and sort of went on, the North and South, having both agreed that African Americans would remain second-class citizens. So when the modern civil rights movement came along, it was found sort of handy that there was already this existing foundation of these laws. And that's why I think the Capitol men and other black officials elected during Reconstruction really historically were very crucial because they responded to these opportunities given to them. And for that alone, even though they struggled and eventually were a lot of the things they believed in and fought for were sort of gutted and sort of wiped away, I believe that their example was really critical because it sort of demonstrated that there was going to be an honest and very capable response, really, to the kind of Reconstruction, the new way of forming the government. Just one last thing, and then we should talk about some of these specific men. But one thing I'll say about the idea of the mythology, which was so persistent and didn't just emanate from uneducated people or popular magazines, but was expounded at Ivy League universities. And, you know, it's in these movies like Birth of a Nation, what's the movie with Vivian Leigh, Gone with the Wind? You know, very pervasive. And even John F. Kennedy in Profiles in Courage wrote traditionally about Reconstruction as late as, you know, the late 1950s. And this is one thing that kind of triggered my interest in the period in that I was familiar with these Thomas Nast cartoons, typical kind of caricatures of Reconstruction, of African-American representatives in a state legislature with their feet on the desk, eating fried chicken and drinking whiskey and sort of really shown as sort of not really being engaged. And then I found the image that is on the cover of my book, Capitol Men, of these very dignified-looking statesmen, really. And, of course, it didn't jive. I thought, well, these two images are completely contradictory, and yet very little is known about these men. So I was kind of intrigued to sort of delve into the mystery a little bit. So let's start in. I start my book with a man named Robert Smalls, who was a congressman from South Carolina, and really a wonderful character. He was known all his life as the boat thief for a colorful incident. During the Civil War, he was a slave in Charleston, South Carolina. That's where the war had actually begun. And Smalls served on a Confederate transport ship. He was a slave. And the white crew and officers were not supposed to leave the boat in the hands of the black crew. But once in a while, the nighttime attractions of Charleston were just a little too appealing, and they couldn't help but go into town and leave Smalls and his men in charge of the boat. So Smalls, who apparently was good at imitating the captain anyway, decided to put this to good use. And so one night, he took the captain's hat and imitated the captain, and they took the boat out of the harbor. This was very dangerous, of course, because they would have all been executed had they been caught. They basically stole the boat. They took it out, and when they got to the sentry post at Fort Sumter, Smalls, in the sort of half-light of dawn, imitated the captain convincingly enough that they were kind of waved through and let out into the open sea. Well, of course, immediately Smalls turned the boat toward the Union Navy, was blockading offshore Charleston Harbor. So Smalls turned the boat that way and was intercepted by a Union vessel and basically turned the boat over and said, here's a gift to President Lincoln. And interestingly enough, at that point in the war, this was spring of 1862, the North had not had a lot of military successes. And Robert Smalls, a slave, became like overnight a military hero throughout the North. His image appeared in Harper's Weekly with a big article about him, a picture of the boat, and so on. And more significantly, his example played a role in a debate that was then going on in Washington among President Lincoln and other cabinet members about whether or not to enlist former slaves in the Union Army. You know, as the Union Army went into the South, a lot of slaves sort of liberated themselves, crossed into the federal lines, and a large number of these men began offering to serve. And of course, a lot of the generals in the field were eager to take them up on this offer because they saw that here was all this manpower. And as I said, the North was having a more difficult time militarily than it had anticipated. And so Robert Smalls came to Washington and basically made the rounds and kind of told his story of stealing this boat. And his example alone sort of defied a lot of the objections to enlisting blacks in the service, in that he was a slave, he had shown that he had thought up this idea on his own, he was resourceful, and of course he was very courageous to pull it off. And he was also he turned out to be kind of a ham. He would go around posing for photographs wearing the captain's hat. They eventually gave him the boat. He became the captain for the Union Navy of the boat he had stolen, which of course was just a way of kind of getting a dig in at the Confederacy about this. It was really, they never forgave him for the rest. He lived well into the 20th century, and they always hated him. They called him the boat thief till he was in his 80s. And he went on, of course, to be kind of a thorn in the side of Southern conservatives. But of course, he did, you know, his advocacy helped win the day for this argument. You know, the policy about emancipation, enlisting blacks in the service, all this was being kind of made up on the run during the war, even though, of course, we think of it as being history, you know, that it was Lincoln maybe saw all these steps in place. But, you know, the president for a long time thought that the former slaves would have to leave America because there really was no other biracial country in the world, and he couldn't imagine that there would be one here. And so his idea was that once the conflict was over, that a country like Haiti or maybe someplace in Central America, if given enough U.S. funds, would be willing to take the former slaves. Of course, it was a ridiculous idea because the slaves identified themselves as Americans as much as anyone else, and not all of them were eager to depart. So it never came to pass. The idea eventually was dropped. But similarly, with the enlistment of black soldiers, it took a while for this idea to kind of take hold. And almost 200,000 black men served in the Union Army. Another person worth talking about is Hiram Revels, who was literally the first black in Congress. I always think of him as kind of the Jackie Robinson of the Capitol men, in that he was kind of chosen by the Republicans. He was an older man, a minister from Mississippi, and a very sort of calm, collected fellow. And the idea was that he would not be ruffled if there was sort of antagonism toward him, which they feared partly because he was taking Jefferson Davis's place in Congress. You know, Jefferson Davis was the president of the Confederacy, but before that he'd been a senator from Mississippi and had last been seen sort of storming out of the Senate in 1861 saying, the next time you'll hear from me, it'll be the end of my point of my sword, basically. So he left in a huff. During Reconstruction, he was in a federal penitentiary, and meanwhile Hiram Revels, an African-American minister from Mississippi, was coming to take his seat. So this was a way, of course, it was like a wonderful public relations coup for the Northern Republicans to kind of, again, rub the former Confederacy's face in this a little bit. And there was, you know, the day of Revels swearing in was sort of like Y2K. People feared that the chandeliers would start rattling and that the plaster would crumble. Or, of course, none of that happened, and it all went very smoothly. But there was a lot of hoopla about it and a lot of attention. And generally, the Southern conservative press was very hostile toward the idea, but otherwise, it was still kind of during the early part of Reconstruction, and people were generally kind of welcoming of the idea. They called Hiram Revels the living 15th Amendment, in other words, that he was embodying this reform and such. Another interesting man was Robert Brown Elliott, also from South Carolina. He was kind of like the most Obama-like of any, not that everything has to relate to Obama, but he was a person who was kind of mysterious origin. He claimed to have lived in England, to have gone to law school there, and yet he also sort of knew all the nooks and crannies of rural South Carolina. And he was only a young man. He was in his late 20s. So the idea that he'd somehow done all this didn't really add up. But people seemed to give him a pass and let him sort of tell whatever story about himself he wanted to. What was known, though, was that he was very intelligent and very eloquent and became known as an incredible orator for the cause of equal rights in South Carolina. What was also interesting about him is that, unlike a lot of the other Capitol men, he was of definite African, and he was not of mixed ancestry in any way, shape, or form. And in fact, they called him the African. And so when he came to Congress, he was sort of intimidating to whites in a way that a lot of the other African-American representatives weren't. And, you know, he looked much more exotic until he opened his mouth and began speaking. And it turned out that he spoke in what they called the African cadences, whites called it, because even that sort of speaking that we associate with the black church, people like Martin Luther King Jr., obviously, and others, was, again, relatively new to a lot of white ears. They had never really heard this kind of language, sort of rhythmic speaking. And not only that, but also the ability to kind of speak truth to power, the kind of grit. A lot of these black representatives had a kind of, one reason they'd been so successful in the constitutional, the state constitutional conventions, is that they actually knew the issues almost better than a lot of the whites in terms of conditions on the ground, so to speak. They lived much closer to it. And when they spoke, it could be very compelling because they had run up against white vigilantes. They'd seen the abuse of the use of land, that kind of thing. So Robert Brown Elliott was a very compelling force. And he attached himself to something that, you know, Reconstruction was a time when the reformers knew they were probably dealing with like a period of time in which they had to take advantage of, get as much done as they could. They knew there was going to be a backlash, and it did eventually come. So they got, in addition to those two amendments I mentioned, there were also the Enforcement Acts, which were meant to protect black voters. But then also there was something called the Civil Rights Act, which they saw as the capstone. And what that was about was not just protecting the black right to vote or to be a citizen, but how people lived in their daily lives, which, of course, is really critical, whether you could ride on a train, or stay in a hotel, go to a restaurant or a theater. That was the kind of thing that was really difficult. And the Civil Rights Act of 1875, it turned out to be called, was meant to finally address that. And so the abolitionists, former abolitionists and other reformers, saw that as their final, that would sort of be the capper, the thing that finally put all the rights in place. And Robert Brown Elliott gave a very eloquent speech in 1874 where he debated the former vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, who was then an old man and sort of was wheeled into Congress and gave this kind of very feeble speech where he basically just parroted things he himself had said before the Civil War about the slaves are happy, why don't you leave us alone, etc. And Robert Brown Elliott just sort of decimated him and went on to give this very powerful speech, a little bit like Obama's speech in Philadelphia last spring, I believe it was, where he basically said, you know, we're not going to emigrate. We're Americans, just like you are. We have long ancestral ties to this country, and we want to be a part of it. We're integral to it. And, you know, at one point he quoted scripture. He turned to the story of Ruth, you know, the whither thou goest, we will go kind of thing. It was a very effective speech and so popular that a lithograph was struck the next day of him giving the speech on the floor of the House. And, you know, he was sort of overnight, just like Robert Smalls had been, he was kind of welcomed. It was kind of an overnight sensation, really. The Civil Rights Act, by the way, then was passed. Unfortunately, it had a rather sorry trajectory. It lasted for about 10 years. It was very difficult to enforce. You know, the thing about regulations and laws is that they can be as beautifully written as you want, but enforcing them is another story. And that's what really happened. And, of course, that's the story of Reconstruction writ large, is that it was very difficult to get the South to cooperate, or even federal government, really, after a point, to follow up on these laws. It became inconvenient. People got tired of, they didn't want to send the federal troops into the South as troubleshooters anymore. President Grant became very self-conscious of being kind of a military dictator, of being like a Julius Caesar, which is what they called him. He didn't want to be seen as the person who reignited the Civil War. So the whole idea of sending the troops yet again for another emergency, you know, African-American voters here are being intimidated and there they're being attacked or what have you, it became too much. And not only the president, but a lot of the American public as well. You know, we see that even in our own time. If people are willing to address a problem or become caught up in something, whether it's fighting AIDS or a war, but if it doesn't go away after a couple of years or the solution doesn't become evident, people become impatient. And that's really kind of what happened with Reconstruction, is that the willingness, you know, the country had the moral energy barely to win the Civil War, but it didn't have the moral commitment then to really see through the follow-up to the war, which would have been to fully integrate the former slaves into American society. And so that's kind of what happened finally, is that the North and the South sort of made a peace in the interest of national reconciliation to basically cashier for the time being this effort to integrate former slaves and all African Americans fully into American life in the interest of kind of moving ahead, confronting other problems that were pressing. Large numbers of immigrants from Europe were pouring into northern cities. You had labor conflicts arising, even in places like Boston. You had large corporate trusts that had never really existed before the Civil War suddenly becoming super powerful, railroad trusts. And, of course, a lot of corruption, which people, both in the White House and elsewhere, people had become sort of fed up. The question was sort of like, how long are we going to keep fighting for the rights of African Americans in the South? At some point, they're going to have to do it for themselves. The few efforts that had been made for Southern blacks to actually militarily stand up to white harassment in the South had not gone very well. There were some terrible massacres, the Colfax Massacre in Louisiana, in Vicksburg, Mississippi. So that option really wasn't going to work. And again, as I said, they couldn't, federal troops, they were needed out west to fight the Indians. They weren't really available to be, and especially a place like the rural South at that time, it was very difficult for troops. You would have needed an army, literally, to maintain the peace. So eventually, and you saw this in the courts too, the Supreme Court, initially supportive of Reconstruction, eventually began gutting a lot of the earlier laws, like the Civil Rights Act. It finally decided Congress had no right to pass this law, essentially. And one of the justices quite infamously said, there has to be a time when these people, meaning the former slaves, have to stop being, quote, the special favorites of the law. And what he meant by that, of course, was that there's only so much we can do. And at some point, the sort of government and the northern public or whoever is interested in this has to kind of stand back and let the South deal with this, and that people living in the South basically deal with this problem. So that's, I'm kind of racing ahead, but that's kind of how Reconstruction sort of unwound. Let me just also talk about, I don't want to go too long because I know you have to get back to another class or something, but there was a wonderful man named P.B.S. Pinchback, who's one of my favorite characters, who was the lieutenant governor of Louisiana. He had been a riverboat gambler. This is like typical of Reconstruction. This man, he'd been a riverboat gambler. He was kind of a flashy con artist sort of person. But at the same time, very beloved in Louisiana, where he wrote a beautiful civil rights statute that was enacted and was in place for about half a century in Louisiana, kind of desegregating the streetcars and things like that. So he was very much admired, despite being kind of a rogue. And he was best known for something they called the Great Train Race. This was typical, again, very typical of Reconstruction. He came to New York for a Republican meeting when he was the lieutenant governor of Louisiana and found that the white governor of Louisiana was staying at the same hotel. Well, he had this idea that if he could get back to Louisiana before the white governor did, that he could, like, sort of muck around with some of the laws. In those days, I guess the lieutenant governor, if the governor was out of the state, the lieutenant governor was free to sort of go to town. And he wanted to change some election laws to sort of favor a faction that he was involved in. So he made a dinner date with the white governor and basically said, you know, see you later tonight. Meanwhile, he hustled over to the train station and headed back to Louisiana. Well, eventually, later that night, the governor sort of figured this out, what had gone on and what Pinchback was up to. So he got a train and he headed after him. You know, in those days, you had to take about 8 different trains transferring at Pittsburgh and God knows where. So meanwhile, the newspapers kind of got wind of this. And this was at a time when people generally, the American public, loved races of steamboats, horses, whatever you had. That was kind of, you know, they didn't have MTV or anything then. And anyway, this wonderful Great Train Race went on. And the governor, it turned out, had greater clout with the railroad than Pinchback did because he tricked Pinchback. He somehow wired ahead. And when Pinchback's train arrived in Canton, Mississippi, getting very close to New Orleans, the conductor said, well, Lieutenant Governor Pinchback, you have a telegram waiting in the telegraph office. And so Pinchback got off the train, went in the office, and they locked him in the office. And so his train took off without him, leaving him on this platform in this little town. And about 3 or 4 hours later, Governor Warmoth's train came through. And so the two men were reunited. And it being Reconstruction, neither of them took it too hard. They just like, well, of course, you're a scoundrel and so am I, so we'll both get on the train. And they, you know, they rode back into New Orleans together. But anyway, Pinchback, he's a marvelous character. He wound up actually, you know, Louisiana, the politics were so fractious there that they would often have like 2 different separate legislatures and governors vying for who, because they couldn't agree who had won an election, which of course was a total nightmare for the federal government who would be asked to resolve these things. But at one point, one of the legislatures appointed, you know, in those days, they didn't elect senators popularly. They just appointed them, U.S. senators. The state legislatures did until 1913. So the Louisiana legislature sent Pinchback to Washington as its senator. I think they probably did it partly just to get rid of him because they figured, well, let him go. You know, he's in Washington. It's like promoting him, you know, kicking him upstairs. But when he got there, of course, he was associated with enough kind of skullduggery that by that point that the Senate refused to seat him. he spent 3 years in Washington trying to gain his seat in the Senate and was turned away many different times. Finally, they just paid him what he would have earned had he been in the Senate for 3 years and told him to go away. And that was the end of his political career, really. But he cut quite a swath across the American political scene. Maybe I should just, I've gone on for quite a while. Do people want to, should we turn it over to questions? That's usually the best part anyway. So please go ahead if you would like to ask anything. Yes.
Thanks very much. That was really excellent talk. I had two questions. One is sort of a technical question about segregation was legal at that time. So what was the configuration when black officials were, you know, heads of government? Were they seated with the whites? How did that work?
Right.
What was the configuration? And also, Washington, D.C. was also segregated. So where were the representatives seated in Congress? And the second question, more broader question, is would any of these representatives precursors to what we would call black nationalists or integrationists in these times?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any precursors for that?
Well, the answer to the first question, it sort of varied from place to place, but the truth is that, you know, Jim Crow segregation, it's commonly believed that that started in right after the Civil War, and there were, like, the black codes, and there were efforts at times to, obviously, to maintain segregation in various places, including Washington, D.C., but the truth is a lot of these places had civil rights laws, including Washington, had very progressive civil rights laws that were passed in the years after the Civil War during sort of the height of Reconstruction. And it really wasn't until about the 1880s that you see the Jim Crow, you know, like you can't play checkers with a black man and all these things that kind of came, all these ordinances that became Jim Crow segregation really came later, about 20 years later. So there was kind of a window. So yes, the congressmen, when they would come to Washington, that was like a refuge for them. What they would complain about, whatever they'd endured on the way there. In other words, coming through the southern states, one of them had to ride, they put him in the baggage car with a cadaver. Other points, they couldn't get off the train to have a bite to eat at a station, this kind of thing. So it was kind of local, these were kind of local problems. But in Washington itself, and a lot of other places like New Orleans, there were civil, and even in Charleston, South Carolina, there were the streetcars were integrated for this brief period of the kind of the glory years of Reconstruction. It wasn't, part of it had to do with the Civil Rights Act itself, and I mentioned they had trouble enforcing it. Out of the difficulty of enforcing it arose the policy of separate but equal, because that was the way that institutions like hotels and restaurants would deal with it. If they were told they have to have this law, you have to treat everybody equally, their response was, okay, well then we'll have the place for African Americans to eat over there, and we'll have the whites will eat over here, which of course was sort of contradicting the intent of the law, but sort of answering it sort of literally. And so you had that kind of, that whole idea of sort of segregation kind of came out of the failure of this attempt to sort of equalize civil rights on a daily basis. And of course that law became, finally, the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That's a typical of Reconstruction, is you had this effort which almost worked, but then it took another 90 years for it to finally be put into place. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, same thing, essentially. And your other question? There was one man, Martin Delaney, who was not a congressman, but who was a black politician in South Carolina, who was sort of a black nationalist. And he is kind of remembered as such. And in those days, his black nationalism kind of expressed itself in emigration schemes to go to Liberia. He became very bitter about, he among many other people, became, another one is Henry McNeil Turner, who was from Georgia, a minister. They became very, especially when the vote began being taken away, they became very cynical about the prospects for African Americans here. And both these men began to advocate for emigration to Liberia. It's also worth mentioning that there was a large exodus movement from the South toward the West, Kansas and Oklahoma, that occurred, again, as Reconstruction sort of crashed and burned. A lot of people, blacks in the South, sort of said, what are we sticking around here for? We're sharecroppers, the economy is impossible, now they're taking the vote away from us, why not just leave? And these Western states would promote themselves as havens. And it was actually set off a fierce debate, in a way, between the people like the Capitol men and Frederick Douglass, who were the more established black leaders, disapproved of this exodus or emigration. They felt that people should stay where they are and fight for their rights, because these men, that's what they had lived for. And the idea that you would sort of run out on it, on the promise of it struck them as ludicrous. Of course, a lot of the actual sharecroppers then said to Frederick Douglass, well, you took off. You know, he didn't stay in this, which set off a kind of strange thing with Frederick Douglass, where then he felt like he responded sort of hotly to this as well. But it was one of the first times that there was kind of a new generation of sort of grassroots black leadership, people saying, sort of ignoring the advice of Capitol men, the senators, Frederick Douglass, the kind of standard bearers, and really kind of going with their own gut instinct. And of course, they were right. The day of equality that Frederick Douglass had promised really was very, very far. I mean, what he was sort of seeing was the civil rights movement of the 1960s. But of course, this was many, many years away yet. So
they had taken a class called The Miseducation of Black Boys.
I feel like I've contributed to that a little bit here today.
And here we have, in the Reconstruction period, all these men who seem to be educated. Where did they get their education? Many of the ex-slaves are scrambling to get any adults or going to classes that are taught by Northern school moms.
Yes.
And today, this whole crisis that we have in black education, if you look from the period of Reconstruction, what has led to the miseducation of black boys that these young students are now trying to understand? Is there any historical lesson we can learn from that terrain?
Oh.
So I've asked you a question on your behalf.
I'm not really sure I can speak too much about the present day, but in terms of the period of Reconstruction, these men had a very sort of uneven levels of education. Of the 2,000 black politicians who served during Reconstruction, almost all of them were exceptional people. You sort of had to be, really, at that place in time. And most of them tended to have either picked up some kind of learning somewhere along the line. A few of the men who went to Congress had actually been to college. In other words, even if they had been slaves, they had had access to maybe a white parent or an interested party had somehow seen that they received an education. But someone like Robert Smalls was illiterate. And when he went to Congress, he hired tutors, basically, because he didn't want to be embarrassed by his inability to read and write. And so he sort of worked at it assiduously because it was very difficult for African Americans to receive any education at all prior to emancipation. When the opportunity was presented to them, we're all familiar with those stories of the schoolhouses with people 90 years old who just want to learn how to read their Bible. There was such a hunger for that kind of education. So yes, you're right, it was kind of uneven, and there were a lot of people who had to really kind of struggle to kind of work their way in. There was such a huge sort of the nadir of the African-American experience post-Reconstruction for so many years that education, it seemed like, has always been, you know, it's never even to this day gotten back to where it should be.
My first encounter with a serious scholarly effort at giving a balanced interpretation of Reconstruction was W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction.
Right.
I'm just curious to know how you think that stood the test of time. It was published, I think, in the early 20th century.
1935, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think the quality that he thought it had has stood up to current sources that you've been able to find?
Yeah, to a great extent. I know that he's been criticized that some of it is not entirely accurate, although I've also seen that explained by the fact that it was impossible in the 1930s for Du Bois. He couldn't really go in the South and do a lot of research. In other words, that in itself would have been very difficult, not only because he was African-American, but because at that point still the whole era was considered such a kind of a dark nightmare that the Southern archives were not at all friendly, even to saving a lot of the material from that era. And those men that he wrote about, the Capitol men, the black elected officials of Reconstruction, were at that time still viewed as outlaws, as criminals. And so the idea that he would have been able to kind of tour through the South researching the book the way a person might today would have been difficult for him. I think looking at it, I used it, and I thought it was actually very, you know, of course it was very innovative in its day. Probably the beginning of this kind of revision of this myth, turning back this myth of Reconstruction as having been this awful thing. And his book was not, it was admired, but it didn't really start a huge later. It was more like in the 1960s that you had kind of a larger wave of revisionism come along and finally kind of overturn this long-standing myth of Reconstruction. But Du Bois definitely sort of fired the first shot. It wasn't like his book really started a revolution in the thought. But looking back now, of course, it was right on target with it. But yeah, I actually found it very useful. I mean, he's Du Bois, because he was sort of a sociologist, he compiles information like nobody's business, you know, lists of income levels, and, you know, he's very, very scientific in his own way. And so it's a great resource, really. And then he would sort of course, if Du Bois, then he'll sort of turn in, then he'll like put a poem in or something. That's kind of his way. He's like, you know, he'll then become very lyrical all of a sudden, right after a bunch of like mortality data or something like that. That's why we love him so much. There he is right there. But yes, of course, there have been books about Reconstruction historiography and how this happened. Like most myths, they serve some purpose, either good or bad. But yes, he was certainly pivotal in there. Yeah.
Thanks a lot. You mentioned Frederick Douglass in passing. I was wondering if you can elaborate on him. You know, in his third autobiography, he actually disparages the notion of running for office, even though he was in highly politicized positions, ranging from being head of the Freedmen's Bank to being a consul to Haiti. So
right.
I was wondering, where does Frederick Douglass fit in the sense of being a statesman who had a lot of political clout and influence? And then secondly, Barack Obama in his memoirs refers to Frederick Douglass quite a few times. And
right.
If you can kind of make sense of the inspiration of Douglass to Barack Obama, because right now a lot of people connect Barack Obama to Abraham Lincoln, but you know, mm-hmm. Lincoln and yeah. Douglass were peers, and in many ways you can see Frederick Douglass as being an inspiration to Barack Obama.
Right. Well, of course, occasionally Douglass would lash out at Lincoln. You know, he would get upset with him. I mean, Douglass figures in my book, Capital Men, quite a bit. He's kind of like the cheerleader, because he really kind of was like scripting this whole thing in a way. He'd been, of course, this sort of well-known abolitionist author whose books kind of inspired a generation of people. And then he kind of watched the Civil War approach. And after the war, once this idea of the black friend, you know, he was all for blacks serving in military, which he sort of got his wish. He was very proud of what they did. Then when the franchise was extended, he was again all for that. And he, of course, founded that newspaper, the New National Era, which was, of course, a very apt name. The New National Era is a wonderful resource for this period, because it's almost like the high school yearbook of the black elected officials of the period, telling all about them and covering their activities and offering portraits of them for sale. And Douglass himself would describe these portraits like, you know, every Southern home needs one of these pictures of whoever it was, Senator Blanche K. Bruce, and just on and on. And then he, of course, was extremely disappointed and made upset by the kind of redemption, which was what, you know, the white reaction against Reconstruction was called. And so that's how he wound up in the moment I mentioned during the exodus west, where you found Douglass kind of still bitterly arguing against allowing the idealism of Reconstruction to slip from people's grasp. He thought it would be a defeat. He lived long enough to see what was called the Mississippi Plan, which was the full disenfranchisement of African Americans through kind of ballot box trickery at the voting registrar's office in the South, through various literacy clauses, the understanding clause, which required an applicant to explain a paragraph from the state constitution, which of course allowed total discretion on the part of the white registrar as to who would get to vote. The Mississippi Plan was then copied by almost every other Southern state. So Douglass lived to see all that, and I'm sure it was a great disappointment to him, although I don't think personally he ever lost. As I said, he always believed that a day would come when there would be this rising, sort of an embrace of equal rights in the South. And your other question was about the connection between Douglass and Obama. I can sort of see that. The thing about Douglass, it's so incredible. And, you know, he's really, I've always admired him, but working on this book especially, he's an incredible writer. Like, I went out and actually got, like, this huge volume of his speeches, and what a gift of language. It's just amazing, incredible. And so in that way, of course, there's a connection. But I think also with Douglass, the thing was so great was that he never let go of the kind of emancipationist vision of America. Like, he had it all. That's what I meant when I said he had it all scripted almost. It's like he was the one who saw it all, and he saw what needed to be done. When it worked, he was glad. When it didn't, he was very upset. But in that way, I think he does have a little bit of Obama. You know what I mean? I think he had it all in sight, kind of, and he knew where it was supposed to go. And I think Obama kind of gives a little bit of that, not only the control of language used very effectively, but also a sense of calm and kind of having a certain object in sight and kind of knowing that that's the direction to be moving in. Yes.
Your talk made me think about some comparative things. And in recent years, we've had situations in different places of the world where we've had democratization in places that weren't democratized before and yet had serious social barriers. For example, former Yugoslavia would be an example. We had Serbs and Croats at each other's throats. And then you have in Iraq, we have Shiites and Sunnis and so on. And we see today, I think, how difficult it is to take a non-democratic, fractured society and just by granting the vote,
yes,
get everything to work out peachy. I mean, I think probably what a lot of the neocons thought when he went into Iraq was, we'll just give the vote to everybody, and then they'll all realize that they don't have to kill each other. They can
right.
just, but it didn't quite work that way. I wondered if you could say, would you say there were lessons that they could have learned from Reconstruction on that same kind of thing? And what sort of real problems are there in that type of situation?
No, that's really kind of the ultimate question. I mean, it's always difficult when you start. So I'm always wary to compare different times and places. But yeah, you're absolutely right. In other words, I think that's ultimately what it was that in so much as it was sort of like nation building, there were a lot of sort of fundamental problems that made it really difficult. One was, of course, that the North was somewhat ambivalent about it. In other words, when Lincoln was assassinated, Andrew Johnson became the president, and he himself was sort of a loose cannon and didn't really get it started on a solid footing. Secondly, there was a lot of real resentment against the South in the North for the Civil War, you know, because it had gotten way out of hand. Many more people had been killed than had been thought. And that kind of seed of real contempt between the two sections was not helped at all by the immediate years after the war, when there was still a lot of bitterness. And I think finally, I guess there was a sort of a vacuum of leadership in the South, really. And again, maybe it just was impossible that this all could have happened. I think the only thing that would have made a difference is had there been moderate leadership in the South. There were Southern Republicans who basically had the vision to say, well, we have to get on this page because everything has changed now, and the planter society we once knew is over, and if we want to move ahead and not get the South sort of left behind, we have to kind of sign on to this. And a lot of them did. Even a couple of former Confederate generals, like Longstreet, became Southern Republicans. Unfortunately, not enough did, and there never was. We needed like a super group, really, of like, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, Lincoln, whoever, Eleanor Roosevelt, maybe, you know, in other words, to counter the harsh, the sort of white resistance, what they called the straight out movement in the South, which was basically saw the Reconstruction as apocalyptic and spoke of it in terms that the Jews used to talk about the Holocaust. They literally never again. To them, the idea that you would allow African Americans to vote and in these large voting blocks in states where they were a majority to control the political scene, even though that never, you know, their fears were overblown, to them that was never going to happen again. And they would do anything. They literally would say that too. We'll do anything. We will kill people. We will stuff the ballot box. We don't care. We're not going to have that ever happen again. And so that force was so powerful that whatever moderate voices there were just unable. And so it sort of was a situation where you wish it could have been different, but there just wasn't that commitment to it from the people who were most implicated, really.
I was wondering if you could say something about the kinds of associations the Capitol men had when they were in Washington, D.C. with radical Republicans like Stevens or Sumner. I mean,
right.
Did they meet? Did they talk? How did they relate to one another?
Right. They had kind of an interesting relationship with them in a way, in that they were in a very kind of delicate position, really, because they didn't want to be seen as being sort of like the puppets of the white Northern Republicans, who were very powerful. Charles Sumner, of course, from Massachusetts, Thaddeus Stevens, who you mentioned. You know, and there were rumors that the white senators were writing the speeches at one point for the African American, which was not true. You know, the thing about being a black congressman at that time was they weren't coming out of like a political machine or even a home base of real great support in their own state. So they were kind of on their own, really, unlike a lot of white politicians who sort of had a whole network they could rely on. So the relationship, it was at times sort of fraught with sort of expectations that perhaps the whites could be doing more. And very often, that's where I think a lot of times that the African-American presence there was really useful, say in establishing something like the Ku Klux Klan Act, which the whites were a little bit sort of on the fence about because they felt they weren't sure they wanted to turn the federal government into like police force. And it was the testimony of people like Joseph Rainey, Smalls, from South Carolina and other places, who basically had contact with the Ku Klux Klan and who helped kind of convince both other congressmen, white and black, and the American public, that yes, the Klan was real. It wasn't like a figment of anyone's imagination, and that it was really dangerous. There's this one incredible scene where Joseph Rainey, who was from South Carolina, comes to Congress and he enters into this debate about whether the Klan is real or not. And he said, well, they just stopped me on the road the other day and told me they were going to kill me. And so this kind of sort of tended to stop the clock a little bit. So, I mean, their testimony and their the kind of effort they could bring was very valuable. There was always that kind of problem of, well, this is more a problem for me than it is for you, and so I take it much more seriously. And, you know, so sometimes feeling like the whites, northern whites, were not, they got it sort of in a larger sense, but they didn't really get the grit of it really as much.
I want to get back to the book itself by sort of saying, where do you place these men? I mean, say, from a historical point of view, they seem to obviously have disappeared. There's a sort of pathetic sort of dimension to the, you know, as lonely sort of fighters who then just get no credit for the real revolution in, you know, right. Southern social structure. The most democratic part of American history could right. be seen as this period of Reconstruction.
Yes.
And so, you know, you gave short bios of them, but I now want to get a more holistic picture. Where do they place, besides a Lincoln, what are these men? You know, are they just figures that can be just isolated, or do they represent something, some particular, what do they right. add to the very nature of American history?
Well, I think one thing that I would say is that, to me, they loom very large in that they were the ones who sort of took up this, they responded to the call, really. In other words, the momentum of Reconstruction itself required there to be a response from those whom it was meant to serve. And I think not only the 16 men who came to Washington, but all of the black voters and elected officials basically responded to that. And so to me, as you say, because Reconstruction, in so much as it stands, is kind of a, it's a sort of an idealistic period, which turns out to have been seminal, I think the fact that they were the ones who really took it at its word and delivered back to it a great amount of commitment and courage and competence, really. So for that alone, I think I respect them a great deal. And I think that was what was inherent in that image that I was attracted to of those men that are on the cover of the book. So, I mean, maybe that's, I don't mean that to be too much of like a hallmark kind of appraisal of them, but when I think of them, that is sort of how I think of them. And the fact that they have been largely ignored or marginalized, and of course, many of them met rather sad ends personally. But that's how I think of them in terms of what they as a group may have accomplished.
Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me here.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture by civil rights historian Philip Dre titled Capital Men, The Epic Story of Reconstruction Through the Lives of the First Black Congressmen. Tonight's lecture was presented by the Boston University College of Arts and Sciences African American Studies Program. Mr. Dre was introduced by Professor Linda Haywood, director of the African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Jared Mooney and Michael Garth, with help from Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.